Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode on the Poetry, People, and Things channel. I'm Megan Wildhood, and I'm here with one of my press mates, Emily Hockaday. She is a poet from Queens who writes about ecology, astronomy, and the city landscape alongside more personal subjects. Her first collection, Naming the Ghost, which is the one we will be talking about today, tackles the onset of chronic illness and parenting through grief. Her next full-length, In a Body, will be out in October with Harbor Editions. This collection looks at chronic illness through the lens of eco-poetry. Emily is the author of 5 chapbooks and has had poems in a variety of print and online journals. Emily, thank you so much for joining me today. I am so excited to talk about this collection with you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Okay. So this collection is called Naming the Ghost. I read it 3 times, and I got a layer out of it each time. So I'm super excited to talk about, there were lines I pulled out of each poem. There's questions about inspiration and about just kind of the process of writing. It was something that spoke so deeply to me as someone who has had to do various difficult things through the weight of grief. I also want to start just by thanking you for this collection. It's dedicated to your father and your daughter, as you write, who overlapped on this earth for 4 short months. I overlapped with my grandfather for 3 short months. And so I didn't understand the absolute devastation of grief that my father must have been going through for the first couple years of my life. And just those formative, like right at the beginning, I was 3 months old when my grandfather died. And I didn't understand him, my father, until I read Naming the Ghost. And it really fully hit me what my father must have been experiencing when I was an infant. So I just want to start by saying that was the first thing that struck me about this collection was how much it must have, I mean, you and my father are not the same person, but just that window into you're just becoming a parent and then you lose a parent. Thank you for helping me understand my father a little better.
Thank you so much for your close readings of it. And also I don't want to say I'm glad it spoke to you because it's like a very tragic circumstance and I really feel for your dad, but I am happy that it could give you some insight there. And also I do know that like there must be so many people out there, you know, who can relate to that.
Yeah, totally. And I think this poetry, I think, is my dad likes poetry. So I'm going to recommend this book to you because I think he probably felt my lack of understanding because I was so young. I never knew him. I didn't know my grandfather. And it was super sudden. So this was something that I can be like, 37 years later, I finally understand. I also really appreciate that you gave really, really strong voice to the worrying over one's own mortality. I made it about 36 years, and that worry really hit me, and it hit me really, really hard last year. It's not like I haven't had people die in my family. All my grandparents are gone, two when I was a child, two when I was an adult. And I'm now watching friends lose their parents. But, it like you gave voice to this saturation, of all of life with the sort of anticipatory grief. And that really helped me feel not alone, in this like, oh, right. Death is a thing that will happen to me.
It is. And our society doesn't talk about it.
Right.
At all. I mean, I think there are other cultures who handle it much better than ours does. And I found it's just something that people feel so uncomfortable talking about. I noticed it after my dad died, that like people were like, oh, I'm here for you. But like, and they were, I don't mean to minimize that.
Sure.
But it definitely felt like there was like a certain amount of grief, like that was allowed to be spoken about. And then like very clear boundaries of like, that's enough, you know? And you know, part of, as you see in the book, part of my grief was like turning it inward and like real fear, you know,
Yes.
Which I've always been kind of a hypochondriac. Right. So I can't say that it came upon me after 36 years, but like it became very profound, like obviously, you know, in the book,
yes,
you can tell, but it became very profound after my dad died. And once I started, you know, feeling the chronic illness symptoms.
Yes. That, I just think that whole, that what you just said about people are there for you, people are there for you. And then it's like time's up and you know, it's not, oh, you should be over it, but it's, you know, we don't really have bandwidth anymore to process grief. And that's always struck me as like, well, sometimes grief doesn't even hit right away though. Like it's
right.
When my grandmother died, it didn't even hit me that she was gone until like the next Mother's Day, which was almost 3 months later. And by then all the cards had been read, all the flowers had died, all the casseroles had been eaten. So we just, and I think it is because there is this unconscious fear of an awareness of our own mortality, and we have no idea what to do with it. So we just push it off. And when it gets in our face, that's why we don't know what to do. And then for those who experience something that they can't ignore, they're like, well, I guess I'm on my own here, this little island where nobody understands. So I want to say to readers that naming the ghost is a thing that will help you feel not alone. I felt understood in my just total awareness of mortality and like all that comes with, in a way that our culture doesn't have words for, doesn't have room for, and doesn't talk about. So I know this is a quirky question. I'm going to get this out of the way just because it's so quirky. But so the cover, people who are listening are not going to be able to see this, but we will link to how you can get Naming the Ghost, and that you'll be able to see the cover there. But it's a lot of purple on the cover, and then purple kind of shows up throughout the collection. And the only reason I ask is because I'm Purple's number one fan. And so I just want to know,
me too.
Yes. So can you talk about, like, without giving too much away, like, does Purple have an intentionally special place in the book?
Totally accidental. I didn't even notice that I had put Purple in there until the cover designer came to me. Oh. And this cover was like one of the first ones that I saw.
Yeah.
And she said, purple keeps coming up in these poems. And so it led me to this, you know, cover, and it like blindsided me. I was like, wait, what? And then I went through and it was, sure enough, purple keeps coming up. It is one of my favorite colors. And obviously I was really feeling it, yes, when I was writing the poems, but it was not on purpose.
Well, that's interesting. That leads me to another question. This cover is super eye-catching. When I was at the AWP in Seattle, at our presses table, that one was screaming from like across the hall, even across the room. So it is very stark. But I was noticing too, especially like I've reflected on this in my own writing, how people ask, "Oh, yeah, what did you think about this, or where did you get this in your this poem or that story?" And I'm like, did I put that in there? And I had to go back and read it. So do you have that experience a lot where people they get so much out of something, they give you feedback, and you didn't consciously put that in your writing? Is that like a common experience, or was this kind of one of the first times for you?
This was probably the first time where I felt like really surprised by it. Other times, usually I'm like, oh, I can see that. Yeah. Or I had some sort of inkling about it, but this was, I really had forgotten that I'd even written the word purple anywhere in the manuscript.
Oh, I love it. Oh, I love it so much. Okay. That's great. So you had mentioned earlier about how this awareness of your own mortality had kind of turned into sort of this fear. And I noticed a very interesting and unique connection that I had not heard before ever, but really spoke to me right away in this line from the poem called Unlike My Husband. And the line is, "A temptation is not always a desire, right? Sometimes it is the darkest fear." And I felt that when I read, I felt it, like when I read that, but I hadn't heard anybody name that connection before. And so I wondered if you could talk more about that relationship between temptation and fear, because we always think of it as temptation is like a desire. We have to resist this thing. But mm-hmm. I immediately recognized, oh, it is about fear as well, even though no one's ever said that before that I know.
So what that line is trying to pinpoint, like the most relatable way I can say it, is probably that feeling that lots of people get when they're like too close to an edge, really high up. That like weird compulsion to like jump, you know? Yes. Or like, am I giving myself away here? Am I telling on myself? I think that's a universal. There's like this strange like desire there, like what would happen, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But specifically for the book, it really became like I wanted out of my life, like at that moment, mm-hmm. because the anxiety was so extremely bad that it was really difficult just to do everyday normal things, like just to like prepare food, just to eat food, you know, it would like turn to sawdust in my mouth. So there was this like weird desire, just like, if what's wrong with me is like something horrible and terminal, just like let it happen.
Yeah.
You know, just like let it happen now so that I don't have to keep basically suffering. That sounds so melodramatic, but it felt very, very dramatic at the time.
Sure.
I mean, I'm telling you, my amygdala was out of control.
Sure.
Very deregulated nervous system going on.
Yeah. And I would say that was evident in Naming the Ghost, but you captured it so well that I think, it was a dramatic thing. Anxiety is very dramatic, but it does speak to the experience of anxiety. I think you captured it really well. Because you can think in your head, this is dramatic, this is wrong, there's it's not that bad, nothing should be wrong, what's wrong with me? And that doesn't touch the experience of it. You cannot talk yourself out of it. It's not a logical thing. It's very dramatic, and it can upend your life. And it totally makes sense that it'd be like, well, if this horrible thing is just going to be horrible, like let's just get it over with now. That makes so much sense about. There's this, I've had that experience of standing on a very high ledge and just thinking, what would it be like? What would it be like to just jump off?
Yeah, it's this weird little desire that kind of peeks its head out.
Totally. And it's terrifying, obviously.
Yes,
but that's a great way of putting that. So there's, speaking of temptation, there's this, you speak of this in several places in the collection, and one place in specifically said from the poem is called The Sound of the Ghost, and it says, "Remember," he says, "it isn't always easier to disappear." And that one also really, really hit me, because it's like, how many times have we thought it would just be easier to disappear? I think that is probably somewhat universal as well. Mm-hmm. So what would you say, like, what tempts us to disappear? And why do we think it'll be easier?
I think, again, it kind of connected to the last question.
Yeah.
It's when life suddenly becomes like unimaginably difficult, which it had for me. And then of course with my father, when he was dying, which he died about a year before my chronic illness started. And I think like I was having both the chronic illness triggered some like grief PTSD, because it really happened around the anniversary of my dad's death. So it was like those two events were sort of coinciding.
Mm-hmm.
But watching him die, like, it is easier on the person who's dying. Even though the husband is saying, like, it's not always easier to disappear. And that's also true. Sometimes it's not.
Yeah.
But like when it came to death, like I remember my mom, like on, I think, my dad's last day on earth, there was something, he was like trying to write us a note. He had ALS and he lost the ability to talk.
Oh.
So he was writing a note like on a whiteboard asking about some errand or some small thing that like had to be done. And my mom was just like, "That's not for you to worry about anymore." Like, not in a very compassionate way. What? She was just like, "You don't need to worry about that. Like, we're all here and we're all going to take care of those things, you know?" So I think I was sort of writing ironically in a way to myself back in time, because death was so much easier on him, you know, than it was for us.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That is so true. It's always easier on the person who gets to disappear, isn't it?
Yeah. And it felt so sad to me to even think of it that way. Right. But also brought me some relief, you know, even though when someone dies of something like unstoppable, like ALS, there's still like weird survivor's guilt where you like go back over every interaction you had with them over the last couple weeks. Like, did I act weird? Did I say something weird?
Yeah.
And it kind of relieved some of that survivor's guilt in a way, to feel like, you know, like things are easy for him now. It's not, you know, he's not like struggling anymore.
Oh, wow.
Which of course is a cliche, you know, and people say it.
Right.
But it's true. It really is true.
Yeah. There's a reason it's a cliche.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how much distance, the other way to say is how much time was there between this experience, this like totally encapsulating experience? I mean, I really felt encapsulated when I was reading Naming the Ghost. You really reproduced that experience very well for the reader. Between that, so the onset of chronic illness symptoms, your father's death, your daughter's birth, all of this, and then the grief that comes with, like, oh, my daughter's never gonna know my father. That, when that came up in the book, I was like, never even occurred to me that my dad might be sad about that. Oh. Hmm. 'Cause yeah, he was 35 when, or 36, when his dad died suddenly. So anyway, how much time between that experience and writing these poems elapsed?
Okay, so I'm like, I feel like it's a complicated timeline.
Yes.
So my dad, I'm going to start with his diagnosis, because it was like very sudden ALS. It was very sudden death for ALS specifically.
Okay.
Not a sudden death in general. So we got his diagnosis in like January, February. I was already pregnant. My daughter was born in July. And at that point, my father had basically lost the ability to talk, although he could still get around with a walker and stuff. It was very fast from the diagnosis. Yeah. They wait a little while to give that diagnosis, though, because it's such a bad one. Like, they first called it Parkinson's-ism. So they were like, it's a Parkinson's-like disease. Yeah. So, like, he had that diagnosis for a few months before they were like, yeah, it's ALS, unfortunately. So my daughter was born in July, and then my dad died in October. So, like, the dedication says they overlapped for 4 months, which I selfishly feel, like, grateful that he got to meet her and, you know, she was there. Like, yeah. I was, like, changing her diaper on his bed, like, on the last day of his life, you know, and he was, like... She was like grabbing on his finger, and I'm glad that like I got to see that happen. And for me, it felt a little bit like closure.
Yeah.
So then after he died, it was like almost a full year before I started getting these symptoms, and the symptoms started as pain. White. So what my diagnosis ultimately was fibromyalgia.
Okay.
Which is like pretty benign. I mean, it's a bummer, but. It's pretty benign, like in terms of what I was thinking, because I was like, sure, I was dying.
Right, sure.
So it started, yeah, obviously. Started as pain and fatigue. And I felt like, you know, very confused by it and like worried. And of course, my brain went to like, well, ALS can be genetic. Like, am I going to die of ALS? Like literally a year after my dad. And then I felt like guilty for like making his death about me, you know, so many complicated feelings.
Yes.
And then I would say it was probably like 2 or 3 months before I started to be like consumed by the anxiety around my body, because fibro is pretty difficult to get a diagnosis for. Mm. It's like a diagnosis of exclusion. So they have to test for everything. You know, I had like pages and pages of tests. The first thing I did was see a neurologist, obviously. And then he did tons of tests, blood work. I went to see infectious disease doctor, just like a number of specialists.
Sure.
Finally, a rheumatologist diagnosed me with fibromyalgia. And at that point, it was like I really needed to hear that diagnosis to like be a sane person. And ultimately, actually, the treatment for fibromyalgia is a SNRI, which also has pain-killing side effects. And an SNRI is serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. So it's also for anxiety. So it was like, oh, this is the pill I need at this exact moment in my life, you know. And they put me on just like the lowest dose, and it helped immediately. And actually, right now, I feel like I shouldn't be like, knock wood. Right now, I'm off it, and I haven't had any bad fibro flares.
Okay.
So the diagnosis and the medication probably came about 6 months after, like, the real crescendo of anxiety started. So it was only, like, 6 months of this misery, but it felt like a very long time to be waiting on test results. Every week, there was some test result I was waiting on that I was sure was going to come back, you know, with some horrible
and especially
message,
if like, you had just lost someone to a horrible illness, and that is very fast for ALS. That's super.
Yeah,
diagnosis to death is less than a year. I've not heard that.
And it's very quick, which is probably better for my dad. You
that
know,
is
in
true,
many ways.
Actually. Yeah, for him.
But
yeah,
like for us, we were kind of expecting, you know, more.
Yeah,
more time.
Years. Actually is usually what it is. And of course it's just like a slow, awful decline for years. But, so yeah, in some ways, I guess that is better for him that that didn't happen that way. But, oh yeah, when you get ALS, you're not thinking you have less than a year.
I think it took us all by surprise. Even the day that we saw him, like, I didn't think he was dying. I was in total denial. I definitely was like, see you on the weekend.
Yeah.
When I left, you know, I did not expect it, which again, maybe it's better, you know.
Sure.
I don't know.
Yeah. So how long did it take you to write the collection then after?
I actually wrote it during, which is possibly why it feels like that, like you mentioned the encapsulating feeling of it. Like I wrote it in it. It helped keep me sane a little bit. I mean, it did not help me keep me totally sane because I was not totally sane.
Sure.
Like I had clinical anxiety.
Sure, sure.
But it helped keep me from like checking into a mental institution, you know?
Yeah.
So I would write these poems. I do like a poem a day practice pretty frequently.
Oh, okay.
I like to produce, you know, I like to feel like I'm being productive and I hate editing. So I was like, I love these poem a days. You just like write a poem every day and then sort of don't look at it again.
Right. Right. Right.
Yeah. And I started, I don't know if it was January or February, but what I was doing was dictating these poems, these daily poems on my phone, like when I would drop off or pick up my daughter from daycare. So I'd like have one hand on my iPhone and one hand on the stroller. And I would just like talk to my phone, which definitely gave me a different kind of poem than I was used to writing, which was cool. And one day I just like started talking about this ghost. And then the next day I talked about this ghost again. And then I like think I wrote some other things for a few days, but then I just kept coming back to this ghost. And then like 3 months later, I had all these ghost poems, you know, and it was like I had accidentally written a collection in like a few months where like my other collections had taken, you know, years.
Yeah. Yeah. That really explains the striking difference in these poems. I've not read poems like this. I read a lot of poetry. And these are distinct. The voice is so distinct in every single one of them. And it's actually very, one of the things that's very distinct about this collection that that I'm aware of is the voice in every poem is consistent. It's so consistent. And that's, it's like, it's a narrative, but it's not a linear narrative. And where are we in this? And where's the timeline? And what's happened? And it was like, you get a little bit into the collection and you're like, oh, this is the experience. You're actually taking readers through the experience where there's no perspective. You're just in it. And I'm like, I don't think I've read poems like that where there's, I mean, the perspective is this is what's happening right now. And I think that's just going to speak to so many people who have had a lot of experiences, whether they've had struggles with mental health, whether they've had chronic illness, we think all of these things like it shouldn't be a big deal, yet I'm freaking out, yet what do I do? It's amazing that you wrote them in the moment. And that they're so, that they really do capture the experience. I mean, obviously one person can never truly know another person's experience, but for me, it's like, oh, that is exactly, yeah, I know and don't know what the ghost is all at once, immediately. It's so good. I think we're talking about, because fibromyalgia, most people know as just like pain, just like everything hurts. And so there's such a fascinating line here from the poem, The Ghost Sleeps. It says, pain's purpose is finite. It would be better for everyone if we could let it go. And that, I don't know why, but I felt really validated by that because it's not the same thing as saying, you know, well, this is going to make you a better person or everything happens for a reason or all of those really annoying cliches that don't help at all when you're suffering. But it is an acknowledgement, a very powerful acknowledgement. Pain's purpose is finite. And it, which gives hope, like it will end, but you don't have to. So what, now that you have some sort of distance from this whole experience, what would you say is pain's purpose or was in that season of your life?
Well, sorry.
That's okay.
When I wrote that line, I think what I was thinking of was the alarm bells that pain are supposed to ring in your brain to say something's wrong. Yeah. Look at it. And I was feeling at the time like these alarm bells were ringing throughout my whole body, like waking me up at night, really intense, very deep aching. And there was nothing wrong. Huh. So it was sort of coming from a less like optimistic perspective, that line, and more just like this pain should be telling me something, but it has nothing to say. And that's kind of what fibromyalgia is. I mean, yeah. Again, it's a collection of symptoms that are not pleasant, right. But pain is the most common, most thought of symptom.
Right.
And it is not telling your body anything. It's just like, misfiring.
Right. So it's like if you put your hand on hot stove, pain is telling you take your hand away, and then the pain stops
exactly.
because it has done its purpose.
Exactly.
And here, the pain doesn't end, but there's nothing actually wrong. You're not having your hand on a hot stove. You're not twisting your ankle.
Right.
You're not doing any of that. Yeah, that's that. But that, I mean, that still sort of seems kind of reassuring too. Like, I mean, yes, you still, there's still like the pain, that the pain is finite, but it's not going away. I think also for like, it's like, oh, maybe, cause I was thinking of it as when I was like, wow, that's really validating. I was thinking of it as like emotional, like, oh, emotional pain's purpose is finite. That means it does end. And here you're kind of talking back to your body like, it's finite. Why are you still doing this? I've gotten
do
all
better,
the
message. Do better, body.
Yeah, do better.
I definitely felt that way toward my body, which is only trying to do its dang best.
Do better. Yeah. And that it would be better for everyone if we could let it go. Yeah, and that's like, that also really, I keep thinking about that line. It's like, if I want to latch onto something that's going to cause me pain, it's like, but the purpose is finite. It's, you're only going to get so much mileage out of that.
Exactly. And I was thinking about my family when I said that.
Yeah.
Like, it would be better for everyone. Like, it just, it affected, you know, my spouse so much.
Yeah.
He was great.
Sure. Oh, sure.
Very
yeah.
supportive.
Yeah.
But like, I can't imagine what it's like to be like, wow, my extremely Satan-seeming wife is suddenly living in the upside down and I don't know how to reach her.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's I think something too, because he shows up a lot in the collection, and it's the sense that I got was that, yeah, it's he's very supportive. And also, how hard must this be for everybody involved? Then also, like, how does someone who is not experiencing the anxiety, the grief, the chronic symptoms that fibromyalgia has, how do you respond to something like that? Like, what, because you are powerless to fix it, and it doesn't go away, and it doesn't go away. And then there's also the daughter. And so I felt a lot of compassion for your husband mm-hmm. as well. It's just like, wow, this whole situation was really terrible. And yet it was the words that you gave to it were so beautiful. I think there's another line here that, and this is sort of talking about, because your daughter comes in too. And I love the ways that childhood shows up in this collection. This poem from, I held this line from the poem, I held the ghost. And the look on the baby's face, the more I loved, the less love I needed. I had to read that so many times. And I kept going back and forth of like, this could be sarcastic, this could be legit, this could be sarcastic, this could be sincere. And then I was like, maybe it's both. Because it seemed like there was a lot of, when I was reading through, it was like, there's so many layers and it's all the meanings. But it's such a stark line. Like, it's true, it's sad, it's hopeful all at once. And love plays a very large role, if sort of as an undertone in this collection. So yeah, I'd love to talk about love's role here, that you have, you know, for your spouse, for your daughter, for your father, and that, how love played a role from others to you as well. And how giving is better than receiving. We hear that all the time. And is that always true?
I'm glad you picked that poem out, because I know we're not supposed to have favorites, but it's one of my favorites. I read that one a lot when I promote the book. Love was a huge part of this book. Mm. And I think, like, the stakes of love are what made everything seem so dire.
Oh, wow.
And are what makes the speaker, you know, quote marks.
Yes.
I mean, when I announce this book, I definitely say it's like a poetic speculative memoir. You know, I don't beat around the bush. There are some of my poems that it's like not me at all, but like this book is not that. It's a very personal book. Yeah. And the love. Yeah. It gives everything else. Like suddenly there's something they'd be taken away. Not to say that my life didn't have beautiful things in it and wasn't meaningful before I had a daughter, but suddenly there was this fear that something would happen to me. She wouldn't remember me. Already she was getting robbed, you know, of my dad, who was awesome and like loved kids and would have been such a good granddad. Like he would have been like a star, really. He always loved kids. He was super into like hands-on science experiments and stuff. Like he would have been the best at it. The best. So already I was feeling like she's getting robbed, you know, not just me. Right. You know, we're all getting robbed. And then it was like when these symptoms came up, now suddenly, like, what's her life look like without me? And that is really what was haunting me, I would say.
Huh. Okay. Yeah.
I love how she's my favorite part of the book.
Yeah.
I feel like she's very, like, precocious seeming in naming the ghost.
Yes.
But I feel like babies, like, really do, you know, because she was, like, anywhere between, like, one and two in these poems. Babies really do like perceive, you know, a lot.
Yeah.
And it is really joyful to just like love another creature and like not expect anything in return. And that's what I wanted. I just wanted to like keep being able to love her, you know, and the fear of this health incident and like seeing, you know, losing my dad and like seeing his absence just like made that feel so important.
Yes. I know we're not supposed to pick favorites either, but yeah, your daughter, the baby, is probably the most, I don't know, it's my most favorite part. I mean, but also the really capturing the experience of anxiety and chronic illness is also my favorite. I like the baby because there's so much genuine bounciness about babies. And I loved the juxtaposition of those experiences. Not that like we couldn't have handled it without the bouncy, but I just loved that it was like, oh yeah, childhood was like that in a lot of ways. For me as well. And also just the ways that loving someone else shapes not just their identity, but your own. You kind of spoke to that too, about what joy it is to just love without expecting anything in return, and how that really changes our identity, I think, because I've heard this. I'm not a parent myself, but I've heard my sister has a daughter as well. And just how it's like, yeah, you really don't understand what selfless love is until you're a parent. And I think on so many levels, that's true. But we don't hear about the joy part of that and how it is so joyful. There was another line that grabbed me about how, at least the way I read it, was how loving another being really shapes who we are. And it's from "The Ghost Finds My Sewing Table." And it is, "The baby sees me stretching and throws herself over me. Now I am a stack of creatures, ghost, baby, and me." And I love that image. Was so strong, even though it's like, how do you imagine a ghost? But it was so like, I am a stack of creatures. Yeah, it made me think of, who makes up my identity? Who makes up me? And so, yeah, just if you would talk about like layers of identity, how do we come to know who we are and what role love, like we've been talking about, plays into that, creating ourselves stacks of creatures that we are.
I think I learned a lot about like identity and also like my brain during this time, like literally, like how brain chemistry works and how the lobes do or don't talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely like the different identities of the speaker come through, like what you're noting with the baby throwing herself on the speaker. Like when the speaker is the mother, I feel like she's the least bothered by what's happening, because a baby does not care if you're having a nervous breakdown. Like a baby does not notice and does not care. And it's really like, it was solace for me. When I was hanging out with Avery, it was like, this is just playing with the baby time. And those were times where I could just focus almost 100% on that part of my identity and not at all think about what else was going on.
Wow.
You know, all the worry. And it was like after Avery went to bed, or if my spouse was there taking care of her and I had time to like start going off in my like wild fantasies of like what horrible fatal illness I had,
right,
you know.
Right.
But when I was there with her, that those times were like much more peaceful, I will say, than other times.
I love that. I love that so much.
Yeah.
I love that because a lot of times we hear about the demanding parts of motherhood. We hear about how isolating it is, how hard it is, how the kids are always crying, how there's always things that are being asked of you, how you're just this 24/7 caregiver and you don't have anything for yourself anymore. And I mean, there, of course, all of that is true. But I also love that being with the baby was solace. I love that. That's so much. I think I would love to hear more about that in our culture, that there's something beautiful about loving without expecting anything in return, and how that actually can be peace. That
yes. Can... I mean, I will say I have the privilege of like having a very feminist spouse who like never ever once expected me to take one iota more of the caregiving than he would take on himself. So that helped it be like a freeing experience that had solace, because like I had so much support.
And that's totally important to name as well. If you're parenting alone, if your spouse is not available, it can feel as a burden. And that's, so to be fair to all of those experiences, and I'm sure that even remembering my own childhood, I'm like, we three kids really gave our mom a run for her money, actually. And I mean, my dad was there. He worked from home. He was like probably one of the original work from home people. And this is not to diminish the absolute demands that motherhood is. And also, I just love that being with a baby, with your baby, could offer solace in a totally encapsulating. That's just the only word I can think of it, because that's how I felt when I was reading this book as well. I think this actually ties a few things together. We were talking about how when you were talking about everybody's getting robbed with your father's death, and how your daughter's not going to remember him. And how you're like, what? Maybe she won't remember me. What's happening? There's a couple of lines that I was actually going to ask about that very thing. So from Forget About the Ghost, it says, it may be that my daughter will forget the ghost until one day she's perhaps a mother herself, watching her own child, feeling something just over her shoulder. And that is there's a couple of other lines that sort of speak to this too. There's so many things I could say. How has the having your child at this particular time, because this, it obviously, we, you know, you didn't time it so that it would be right around the time that your father was dying. But like, what has having your own child taught you about like your parents, and maybe your childhood? Because you're sort of, okay, projecting into the future. What about when my daughter is a mother? But what about when you look back at you as a child? And like, how has this sort of taught you or changed your perspective about your own childhood, having this child at this time?
That's a good question. I feel like I have an answer that's sort of cheating. Because I live with my mom. We live in a two-family house together. During the pandemic, I was like, come to New York. Okay. Get a house with us. So I see her all the time, and we talk a lot.
Okay.
And we talked a lot, like, during my little nervous breakdown, as I like to call it.
Sure.
And she mentioned that there was a period of time when we were all little, there's three of us,
mm-hmm.
where she was going to the doctor constantly. She was like, every little thing. I went to the doctor to get it checked out because I felt like these three people are relying on me. And she became worried, you know, about her own mortality and like needing to be around long enough to like raise us up. And I like hearing her say that was really validating too, because I was like, this is a universal thing. It doesn't even take like a weird, unexpected chronic illness that like plagues you and keeps you from sleeping.
Right.
To have these feelings of concern around your own health after becoming a parent, because it's true. Like you expect like to be around.
Yeah.
Like 18 years or more, hopefully many more, but like the prerequisite, like I raised them and I sent them. And my mom, it's funny because like, I never would have guessed that as a kid. Like I don't have any memory of that at all. You know, it didn't even, you don't really think about until something happens. You don't really think about your parents' health.
Right.
As a child. It's like, I mean, as it should be,
yeah.
I wouldn't want like Avery, like sitting around worrying over my health, but it just showed me that I was very single, like in interior focused as a kid, as like I said, all kids, you know, usually are.
Right.
But I had no clue that my mom, it didn't occur to me she was going to the doctor more than other times or if she went at all, you know?
Yeah. And that sort of juxtaposition of when a kid is worried about that, what kind of damage it can do, like that. Mm-hmm. There is something, the line feeling something just over her shoulder. Well, if that happens when you're a child, I mean, I have a former partner whose mother died when he was 13, and she was diagnosed with cancer when he was 2. So,
oh wow,
that feeling of something just over the shoulder, I think, is something that he probably experienced and couldn't explain. I mean, you know, when you're 2, you don't know, you just know something is wrong, and that's not how it should be. So this poem, this, now that even discussing this, I have a lot more compassion for him as well. Because it's, as a kid, you are supposed to not be aware of your parents' issues or worried if they're going to be there the next day or whatever. And that's like, that was his whole childhood.
Right.
It's
a very uncertain way to live.
Yeah. And then it causes all these attachment issues and, you know, people just could wink out of existence at any moment. And it's like, when you're an adult, you can handle that. But at least a little more. I don't think any of us can really handle death. Something totally wrong with death.
No.
For sure. But yeah, when you're a kid, you're just like, it just, so much devastation can come from that. There's a line that I pulled out that we were talking about, the solace that that you were talking about. I understand this line a lot better now. And it's from Thank the Ghost. And it said, sometimes it is only that little girl who keeps me tethered. And I get it so much more. I mean, I felt it and now I get it so much more. Because that makes sense that this is just playing with the baby time.
Yeah, it was weird. It was like, simultaneously, I was like trying to cling to life as hard as I possibly could. But also I felt like I was like floating out in outer space, like out in the asteroid belt, like so far away from everyone and just like yelling, you know what I mean? Across this great distance.
Yeah.
Like an insurmountable distance. So it was weird. It was like,
yeah.
I wanted really to be close, but felt so far out.
Totally. Yeah. That, and I felt there was that, I kept feeling a push-pull throughout this collection too, which is like, that doesn't help anxiety at all because there's nowhere to land. You're just, am I here? Am I there? And yeah, that, so you captured that part very well as well. Oh my gosh, there's so many more questions I could ask. I'm going to just pick maybe two. I know we're at time here.
That's fine.
So I mentioned childhood and how I love how childhood shows up in this book. I'm very curious about this particular line that's from The Ghost Has Started Reading, which is just an amazing title for a poem. We find books like I'll Love You Forever and Runaway Bunny open and stacked next to her crib. These are the books I can never get through. Icicles from childhood that lodged between my ribs and still, in adulthood, haven't melted. I keep saying this. I felt that. Yeah, for me, it's Goodnight Moon. Like,
yep.
It's a simple, it's not, it's just a bored book. That's it. And yet I can't read it to my niece. I can't read it at all as an adult. What is
Good Night
Moon
is wild. Good night, nobody. Who's nobody?
What is happening?
Who's supposed to be there?
Yeah, you're right. It is really haunting, actually.
It definitely is.
How is that a child's book now that I think about it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this frozenness, though, because I really related to that. Where does that image come from? That felt very, I don't know if it's universal for everybody, but really, like, what gets frozen and how does it get frozen in childhood? And should we thaw those things out at any point?
We probably should. I know if I try by reading I'll Love You Forever, I'll just die in a puddle of tears. I can't with that book. My mom loves that book because to her it's about love, which it is.
Yeah.
It is about love. It is. Absolutely. It's beautiful. But when I read it as a kid, it was just about one day your parents are going to die and you're going to have to like take care of, not have to like, of course I would want to take care of them. Yeah. It was just that they were dying is the thing that I could not get over.
Yeah.
And Runaway Bunny, sister book to Goodnight Moon. Yeah. Similar themes of like trying to like get away from, like I didn't want to get away from my parents. I was not one of those kids. Like, so it like made me so sad to like imagine this mom like chasing after this bunny who kept trying to escape. I don't know. I think like when I was a kid, the feeling of anxiety that I had really was like a frozen ice. You know, I mean, I've felt anxiety now so many different ways. Yeah. Like,
sure.
I know all the different permutations.
Yes, unfortunately. And it shows up many ways here. Yes.
But when I was young, that like very cold sensation was often how I experienced it. And it reminded me of the myth of the Snow Queen, where the child gets like the icicle lodged in them. And it's like, it takes this great magic to like bring love back.
Wow.
To them. So that was the reference.
Wow. That's amazing. Oh, that's so good. Oh, it's so good. Oh, I want to read this again.
I get some Hans Christian Andersen in there.
Yes. Oh, so, okay. So I have to choose between questions. Well, okay. So I have just technically one more, but, then, well, okay, so I'll say, how did this writing of this collection, how did it change you? Because I felt somewhat of a progression. I mean, it was still a very encapsulating thing, but it did feel like there was some sort of sense of time passing in some way, even if it was kind of a circle sometimes.
Well, I definitely intended there to be a narrative arc.
Yeah.
With some closure at the end. Not like the most closure, but closure in that, I feel like, spoiler alert, but the last poem references the ghost as like a passing traveler.
Yeah.
And it's this idea that like maybe you've wrangled your amygdala today, but like it's, you know, you might have another crisis.
Yes.
That's life, you know? Yeah. Like, things happen.
Yeah.
Crises happen.
Yeah.
And, like, hopefully you'll know what to do. And, I mean, that is something that I've been, that I thought about a lot when I was writing the book, and also, like, since getting, like, quote, better, you know? And I say it with quotes, but, like, I am better. My therapist is like, you're good. You don't even need me anymore. I'm like, don't ever say that. But, like, she saw me, you know, through a nervous breakdown. And really the truth is, like, I did heal. And getting the diagnosis helped heal me, of course, because, like, not knowing what's going on with your body, like, I mean, that really triggered the whole thing. But, like, I also needed to heal, like, learning how to cope and just, like, there's all sorts of healing that goes on.
Yeah.
And the idea is that these things might happen again, but hopefully they won't, like, take the speaker so much by surprise, you know? Because I think really that there was a lot of shock for me, like, one day, and it wasn't like this. It was very gradual, but, like, it felt to me at the time, one day, I had all my sanity and I was totally fine. And the next day I was living in this alternate reality where I was sure I was dying of ALS, even though doctors were telling me I wasn't, you know? So it's like, and I recognized it even at the time. I was like, wow, like, logically these test results should make me feel better. Practically, they do not.
They do not.
I am still panicked, constantly panicked, you know? And, took a lot to, like, get through that panic. And I have to credit my spouse for passing some advice along that he got, which was that, quote, like, your wife feels like someone is chasing her with a knife. She can't meditate her way out of it. Because I was trying to do it without medication. I was like, I can get better. I'll just, like, breathing exercises.
Right.
And, you know, once I get my
mind over matter.
Like, everything.
Mind over matter.
Be fine. Yes, but that's not real.
No.
And my therapist was like, actually, your two lobes don't talk to each other. You can't, like, your amygdala does not, it doesn't, like, respond to logic.
Yeah, it doesn't care what you say.
You can't think at it.
Right.
She's like, sometimes you can, like, breathe at it and, like, do really big, deep breathing. There's way to, like, deregulate your nervous system. She's like, but you're in, like, a full-on, like, amygdala overdrive right now. You know, this isn't, like, you can't deep breathe out of it. Like,
right.
Like my spouse said. So I think, like, that was, like, a big part of the trajectory and, like, what I was learning writing the book and what I've learned really since writing it too, that, like, a mental health crisis, like, will happen. And, like, it can be got, you know, you can get through it.
Yes. Yes. And it did. I did feel closure. I mean, it wasn't like kittens and moonbeams and bows, but it was.
Right.
This time, this ghost is on its way. And it.
Right.
Maybe it will come back. Maybe a different ghost will come back. But this one is saying goodbye. And. Yeah. And that was validating in both ways, because it was like, yeah, you can get through it. And also, let's not lie to ourselves that, oh, it'll never happen again. Everything's fine. We've, like, totally sealed off all entrances to a ghost now.
Exactly. Yeah. I feel like being realistic is a big part of it.
Yeah.
And also, like, even though it wasn't the happiest, most closure-y closure, I'd like to think that, like, there's the, without the ghost, there's, like, the daughter and the spouse and, like, the mom's a character. And, like, of course, there's still all this grief that has to be sorted through.
Yes.
And, like, we'll last. Yeah, we'll just keep coming up at random moments, you know?
Yes.
For a long time. But, like, ultimately, things are on an upward trajectory.
Yes, I did. And I did feel that. I say feel so often, which is great, it's great. This really put me in my body in a way I had not experienced before in reading poems. Is there anything that I didn't ask you that you wish I would have?
I feel like your questions were very thorough, actually. I feel like I talked so much about my mental health and other... other things. Yeah, no, I feel like we really covered a lot of ground here. Thank you for your questions.
Yes, thank you so much for this collection. I'm going to ask you to read we'll close here, if you would read How the Ghost Got In.
How the Ghost Got In. It got in through the open window, on early morning shafts of light, in the morning dove's song, up the copper pipes and through the floorboards, carried in particles from the radiator's steam, in my dreams, in my husband's dreams, my daughter's dreams. It came through the front door. It brought baggage and gifts, secrets and stories. It came in the light of day and under cover of night, sometimes quietly, sometimes with the clanging of backed up plumbing or the harmony of lullaby, sometimes with a chill, sometimes with a fever. It arrived and kept on arriving.
Thank you. And thank you so much for naming the ghost. We will make sure that readers know how they can get this encapsulating collection that really truly captures what it's like to live through a nervous breakdown in a way that is relatable and just enlightening as much as it is encapsulating. Thank you so much for joining me today, Emily.
Thank you.